Long story short, we can predict your future risk of heart attack based not only on those genetics, but how disease has manifested in your particular family is very key. And also how your individual biochemistry is looking and what your lifestyle looks like.
Welcome to the Precision Medicine Made Simple podcast, where we simplify the complex world of precision medicine. We're here to explore how personalized healthcare can empower you to understand and improve your health to live a longer and healthier life. Join us as we break down the latest in medical science into actionable insights. Let's make precision medicine accessible and actionable for everyone. Enjoy the show. Today's episode is sponsored by Biography Health, where healthcare meets personalization. With their DNA-enabled blueprint, Biography Health empowers you with a health plan based on your unique DNA, aiming to prevent disease and extend your life. Take control of your health journey with a plan as unique as you. Visit biographyhealth.com and start your personalized healthcare journey today. As a reminder, this episode is for educational purposes only. This episode is in no way a replacement for professional health advice. Please consult with your professional primary care provider for medical advice. If at any point you feel that a topic discussed on our podcast was misrepresented, or if you have additional insights that could enhance our discussions, we wholeheartedly encourage you to reach out to us. Your feedback is invaluable in helping us improve and in ensuring our content remains both informative and reflective of the latest developments in precision medicine. For today's episode, you're jumping right in the middle of our conversation with Dr. Stanford, Alyssa Stanford, and Taylor Koo. We discuss the nuances of heart disease and how genetics, family history, and lifestyle play a significant role, and so much more. You can find the timestamps in the show notes.
I had a case yesterday. I had yet another case yesterday where guy has no idea he's at risk for heart disease. You look at his family, and there's little buzzwords like vascular dementia or died at 90 but had a heart attack much earlier. But none of those things rose to causing this particular individual guy concern. But when you look at his polygenic risk score, so in other words, looking across a lot of gene variants, what does his risk look like? It looks high. When you look at his lipids, they're not good. And that provoked me to send him for a coronary CT angiogram with calcium scoring, and the calcium scoring put him up in the 50 to 75th percentile at age 46.
That's a great 46.
And when we did the angiogram portion of it, his vessels are pretty clear, which is what you would expect from someone that's 46, except in the left anterior descending, also called the widowmaker coronary artery, he has a 50% Goomba, a lot like your sister.
Okay, so we got to call it something other than Goomba, but yeah.
This is a dumb question, but I never really figured out the difference between atherosclerosis and heart disease. Are those two interchangeable terms, or are they completely different?
That's an excellent question. So certainly, coronary artery disease is the most common form of heart disease. Now, you can have cardiomyopathies also that, in fact, can be caused by heart attacks. So, for example, if you've had heart attacks and your heart doesn't squeeze completely right, then that's called heart failure. You can also, though, have heart failure that's caused by hypertension, where the heart walls get very thick and the heart doesn't relax, and that's the diastolic heart failure. You can also have amyloidosis or iron infiltration in the heart, and it doesn't squeeze that well. You can have valvular heart disease. You can have leaky valves.
A
dilated cardiomyopathy can also be caused from coronary artery disease eventually. So the straight answer to your question, heart disease and coronary artery disease are not the same thing, but certainly coronary artery disease is the most common culprit in leading to heart disease, which is suboptimal function of your heart. that people have confusion about. What is atherosclerosis the same as hardening of the arteries? You know, sclerosis is the Latin for hard or stone or rock or something.
Okay.
And it is, there is hardening of the arteries, and there's also narrowing of the arteries, and they're not necessarily the same thing or the same biologic process. The narrowing of the artery that occurs with the accumulation of cholesterol in the artery wall, which we call atherosclerosis, can lead to a process of calcification around it as the body seeks to stabilize and contain that inflammation associated with that plaque. So the calcification is the hardening, and the accumulation of cholesterol that causes the narrowing is the narrowing.
So I know somebody who's had, so this is how I could do, like, you could say, my sister, like, I know somebody who has this thing that's soft inside and they're afraid it's going right. to break off.
Right. So that's a great question. And that's a good segue into this case I had yesterday, is that there's basically two kinds of plaque. And people ask all the time, well, is atherosclerosis reversible? And the answer is yes. It's an active process. There's constantly cholesterol being trafficked in and out of the artery wall. And there's constantly a process of an active biologic process that the body does to use calcification. It happens to be what I did my PhD in, by the way. It's the calcification that occurs around the plaque itself to stabilize it. So when you get one of these coronary CT angiograms, which is imaging of the coronary artery, they're going to talk about the amount of stable plaque and the amount of unstable plaque. So if the plaque is fully encapsulated with calcification, it's considered, I guess, mature, if you will, and contained and not likely to have plaque rupture. So one of the things we haven't talked about is, how does atherosclerosis lead to a heart attack? And the answer is that this accumulation of lipid, cholesterol, fat in the artery wall, it's very inflammation provoking. So the body's lymphocytes, the white blood cells, the cells that deal with infection in foreign bodies, when you get a thorn and you see this little pussy stuff. So that's white blood cells that are going in to try to create some inflammation and heal that ultimately. In the artery wall, it's the same thing. When this lipid starts accumulating in the artery wall, then the body's immune system goes to try to deal with it. And trying to deal with it creates a lot of inflammation. And initially in that process, it's a very unstable process, meaning that this accumulation of fat and cholesterol in the artery wall is covered by a very thin membrane. If that ruptures, it's very thrombogenic, which is the medical term for a clot's going to form there and cut off blood flow beyond that. And the tissue that is subtended by that artery, that's fed by that artery, will die. And if it...
Will it travel too? Could it, the clot travel and it do like a rate of stroke or heart attack?
No. So if you have a clot that forms in a coronary artery, think of it as the artery goes from bigger to smaller.
Uh-huh.
So the clot is going to form. And if it does migrate, it's going to plug up as soon as it gets to...
It stops the flow.
Yeah, it's going to stop the flow from that point on.
So when like, is, so you mentioned that there were signs, like even when people are younger, like how, at what age does this really start to happen? Because I mean, I can imagine it's like a case by case basis then.
Yeah, it is. You know, there was, what's her name? Stormy Jones. So back in the 70s, when they were first understanding the role that cholesterol played in heart disease, there was a family identified that where the family members were having heart attacks like in their teens and 20s and even earlier. There was this very famous, brave girl. Again, I guess this was probably the 80s because I was living in Dallas at the time, and that's where a lot of this atherosclerosis research, before I went into medicine at all. But this was the kind of human interest story that was in the news every night. Oh, I know why. It was because the girl was from Dallas. She ultimately was the first person to undergo heart and liver transplant, simultaneous heart and liver transplant at the University of Pittsburgh. But what caused her disease and caused her to have heart attacks at age 12 and 14 and the like was she had a disease called familial hypercholesterolemia. And that's where the liver does not clear cholesterol from the body. So if you have a genetic tendency toward having high levels of cholesterol, these are the people that have total cholesterols around 600 or 900, just these sky high, and these sky high LDLs, it can happen as early as 10 or 12 years old. Many of us are walking around, including myself and probably a third of people, maybe, you know, have some form of that, have some, you know, milder form of that disease where they have a very unfavorable cholesterol profile, and they will start manifesting evidence that the disease process is underway in their teens and early 20s. So how do we know that? Well, over the course of time, some of these kids unfortunately die from accidents, car accidents, gunshot wound, whatever. When they do autopsy on them, they see evidence even in the teens and early 20s of the onset of this disease. And I don't mean sometimes, I mean usually, which tells you that this disease process that ultimately is the leading cause of death and kills a third of the, you know, people on the planet starts in the teens and 20s with a decades long run up. Not like Stormy Jones, where it's accelerated and happens at age 14, but has a very long runway and a very long run up to get to the point where you have enough cholesterol and inflammation actively going on in the wall of your coronary arteries that can lead to plaque rupture and a clot formation and a heart attack.
Would genetic sequencing identify that young? Like if somebody were to be sequenced at, let's say, 18,
yeah,
would that show up in the
report? Yeah, so I'll go back to the familial hypercholesterolemia, for example, Stormy Jones kind of thing. There's certainly single gene risk you can look at that would portend a higher, more accelerated course of disease. There's also, though, for many of us, most of us, you know, it's not just a single gene that's causing the acceleration, although frequently there's a handful, but it's many genes playing together. The ability to deal with large data sets these days allows us to look at your entirety of your gene variants throughout your entire genome and compare that to other people in the population that have gone on to have heart attacks or not have heart attacks. And to make a long story short, we can predict your future risk of heart attack based not only on those genetics, but how disease has manifested in your particular family is very key. And also how your individual biochemistry is looking and what your lifestyle looks like. It's an integrative approach where genetic risk is one of the factors we integrate together. How the disease manifests in the family, how your biochemistry is manifesting, and what your lifestyle and other risk factors look like. We can roll all that together. That's what we do at Biography Health and how I do it at the Beverly Hills Institute for Precision Medicine. And we can make very, very targeted, common sense recommendations to modifiable risks, and probably in most cases, modify people's risk, not only reduce it to average and maybe from well below average. And in the best case scenario, especially in the case of heart disease, I believe that we can use this approach to stop the progression of heart disease in most people, even reverse it, and prevent most people from ever dying of heart disease. In my opinion, there's no reason that coronary artery disease should be the leading cause of death. It should be the 10th or 15th or 20th or rarely a cause of death.
I have a follow-up question here because you use the term unfavorable cholesterol profile. Now, aside from getting your genetics sequenced, are there like any external, I guess, signs that somebody would see or know if they did have anything? Like, am I walking up some stairs and then out of breath? And I was like, this guy has unfavorable cholesterol profile.
So you're really asking two questions. And so I'm going to answer the first question specifically. And that is, there are very esoteric tests that will tell you whether your cholesterol profile is favorable or unfavorable. They'll not only tell you the standard lipid panel, which is, we all know, the LDL, the bad cholesterol, the HDL, the good cholesterol, the triglycerides, how was that ice cream last night? You know, not just those, but we'll get into this, some other valuable information, which is the size of the LDL particles, which the smaller the LDL particle, the less favorable. The types of the good cholesterol. And these tests, for example, what's the Quest one called? It's called Cardio IQ Advanced Lipids. And they actually will tell you, are you A or B? A is favorable, B is unfavorable. And not only that, what's kind of interesting, and I guess this opens up a whole other course of conversation, but I've had patients go from A to B to A, just that if you look back, they've had this test multiple times. And so that tells you that you can most often with medication and lifestyle, change your lipid profile from being unfavorable to favorable.
I have a friend, she's 80 years old, and she went a few years ago to get her CT angio, and she had her baseline, which was to go on 20 things of statins and change her lifestyle a little bit, and then she just saw her at the grocery store. She went to the same cardiologist, did the exact same as a follow-up CT angio, and she was telling me that her blockage improved by 20%.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, we do see that. And it's when you do one of these, so we identify someone's at risk, then the next thing to do is a picture's worth a thousand words. In some of my colleague, cardiologist colleagues would say, Bill, why are we doing all this stuff? Why don't we just take the picture and look? And the answer to that is never. Not everyone's got a couple grand to drop on a coronary CT angio with interpretation, over and over again. And not everyone wants dye injected into them. So there, it does make sense to stratify who's most likely to benefit from that test prior to subjecting them to the cost and invasiveness of it. So it's not necessarily something I recommend for everyone, but it is something I recommend for a lot of people. And to get at your point, yes, I've seen cases. Now you could say this is within the error where people have not owned it, that have literally changed their risk category. It's something called CADREDS 1, CADREDS 2, CADREDS 3, which talks about the degree of narrowing you have and the stability of the plaque and the number of those particular areas. I've definitely seen cases where people have changed category. That's improved based on aggressive treatment.
Is there it's hard to say, but like, is there an average time or a consistency that somebody needs to be able to change the trajectory of their lipid profile then?
Like 6 months, 1 year.
Well, you're gonna change your, with appropriate medication and lifestyle modification, et cetera, you're gonna see a change in your lipid profile within a couple months. The cases that I'm talking about where we see that translate into an improvement in disease category, in a coronary artery disease category, is certainly a year or less. I'm thinking in my mind right now of a couple of times I've seen that occur in the course of 1 year.
So it would be, so you wouldn't have to keep doing the DNA testing every year, right?
The answer, of course, since it's coming from me, a Libra, has to be two answers. It's the first answer is when you do whole genome sequencing, you're able, and even if you, and that's whole genome sequencing is one type of sequencing where you do every single letter. There's another thing that's called microarray testing where you do like the 23andMe type thing where you target certain areas. And you target maybe a million of the 3 billion letters. Whole genome is all 3 billion letters, so to speak, of your genetic code. And the microarray is looking at, say, up to 1 to 2 million of those 3 billion. Now, so to answer your question, when you've done whole genome sequencing, it at least for at this point, then, in history, we have gotten 99% of those letters that, and we have high confidence in that, and we're able to use that data set to adjust to any algorithms that come out now and in the future. So
you don't have to do, you, once you do it, your genes don't change.
Your genes don't change. What does change is the fund of knowledge that, and the quality and the ability to predict future disease. Okay. So right now, if we're we're in the infant stage, so to speak, of this process. So even right now, and often when I have patients, I go, gosh, you're really lucky. If you had come to me 2 years ago, there's not a single thing I'm offering you now that I had 2 years ago. And I also have to tell them, that you're going to want to check back with me in 6 months or a year, because there is just an onslaught of new types of algorithms that are out there. And as you mentioned before, AI is going to make those even more and more and more predictive and even easier to generate. So, and as more and more people become part of this process, you're going to have a better data set to train your algorithms on, so that they can predict for any
like more diversity, more situations.
And that's another key thing you're touching on, is that most of the genetic testing right now is based on, you know, European males.
Yeah. Because that's where they start. That's who started this ball rolling. Is that?
So certainly the UK data bank was the source of a lot of the fodder for generating these algorithms. There has been a very focused effort on increasing the diversity of those data sets. Some of you, whoever's listening to this, might know that of the All of Us program. So there is a concerted effort to sequence a wide variety of people. I believe their target is 1 million, and they're at like 600,000 or something crazy. But
by the National Institute of Health.
Yeah, actually, just one additional follow-up question. This is more of just like a shameless, selfish question. But because I am Filipino, and Filipinos love to eat very fatty foods, I do have several family members that have had diabetes or even just has heart disease. I could imagine that the foods that they eat, since it is very fatty, that accelerates atherosclerosis and the hardening and the blood clots that are happening within our arteries. But I can also imagine there's probably some form of genetics that's in there too that just
nature versus nurture.
So it's a great question that you're getting at. So let's just start by saying that diabetes is an independent risk factor for heart disease, and that there is a huge metabolic component to things. But let me also say that it's not just what you eat, and it's not just high fat food. So for example, the reason that it was thought that high fat diets led to heart disease is that, and I mentioned before, I worked in an atherosclerosis lab, did my PhD in an atherosclerosis lab at UCLA back in the 90s. And we found that when we fed mice a high fat diet, they got a lot of atherosclerosis, like really fast and really bad. And that framed a lot of that thinking. But guess what turned out? What's the problem with that?
Mice are not
people. That is really
okay.
Congratulations. Mice are not people. And it turns out that mice are one of the few animals that happens in. Okay. You know, so for example, you can feed your dogs all the fat, they're not going to get atherosclerosis. So it turns out to be just certain kinds of fat. So for example, you know, diets, fats are very important part of your diet. And there are healthy fats and less healthy fats, omega-3 that you get in fish and plants, and versus omega-6 that you get in animal fats. You know, those can be, you know, somewhat more atherogenic, but lots of vegetarians have just as much risk of heart disease as someone that is an omnivore. Mm. And one of the reasons, Brad, if you're just looking, and this is why it's a longer answer, but just looking at cholesterol, most of the cholesterol is made by the liver in your body. It's not what you eat. Most of the cholesterol you eat goes out in your poop. So most of the cholesterol that we measure is manufactured in the body, has a huge genetic component. Now, you touched on diabetes. Diabetes is another disease custom made for precision medicine, because you can identify the risk. You can measure, you know, certain biochemical things like what are your fasting insulin levels? Is there evidence of insulin resistance? And we know that we can definitely prevent the onset of diabetes with exercise and diet. That's been shown over and over again. And so mitigating your risk of heart disease, it's clear that you can mitigate the risk of heart disease with exercise and diet. by avoiding that metabolic derangement of diabetes, which is going to accelerate atherosclerosis and accelerate a lot of vascular issues.
So with one thing that came into my head was you mentioned that the liver is what processes then like the cholesterol, and that's even how some, let's say, vegetarians can still form heart disease later on in life. That's just how the liver processes it. So I need to somehow get my liver better then. And because is that considered then pretty much the root cause, or like one of the main cause? Like if I improve my liver somehow, not by drinking a ton of alcohol and make it better. I don't even know if there's like medicine to improve my liver or anything like that, but would that then be one of the actionable items that I can take to?
So the answer to that is just even a healthy liver with the wrong genetics, which is not oddly enough, is now modifiable. I want to tell that story here in a second. Come back and make sure you ask me about how familial hypercholesterol can be treated. But suffice to say that if you have the kind of genetics, and let's keep in mind that we're usually talking about the LDL receptor that clears LDL from the body. It's not necessarily that your liver or your body is producing too much cholesterol. More often, it's the LDL receptor, which is the culprit in familial hypercholesterolemia, that clears the cholesterol from your bloodstream so that it is less likely to be accumulating in the blood vessel walls. So having said that, there are metabolic things you can do. There are things you can do to support your liver. I'm sure you've heard of fatty liver disease. So metabolic health and a healthy metabolism, when I say that, I'm talking about the insulin glucose type physiology, biology, just that function, how far away from being insulin resistant you are, how healthy that insulin glucose axis is, has a lot to do with not developing fatty liver, which can lead to cirrhosis and require a liver transplant. I heard some crazy statistic lately. It used to be Hep C was the leading cause of people getting liver transplants, and it's projected if the obesity situation continues like it is, that the leading cause for requiring a liver transplant will be fatty liver disease, which progresses to cirrhosis. Which is through diet. But if you want to feel lucky to be alive in the year 2024, so I think the two of you have heard about gene editing. Would you believe that a company has come up with a way of packaging that gene editing CRISPR-Cas9 machinery into a liposomal particle that will home preferentially to liver and modify that genetic defect that results in familial hypercholesterolemia, FDA approved? I don't mean just that they've shown the theoretical ability to do it. They've done it, and they've showed that they can do it safely and effectively.
In this country.
Yeah.
Call me dumb. Not only did I not believe it, I also didn't really understand.
Most of us have heard that there's this ability to do gene editing. It's very exciting. It's
okay.
Clear or cure sickle cell anemia, which is a single gene defect. And that's done. And the reason why that's one of the first therapeutic targets is that you can take the blood stem cells out, do your little gene editing thing on them, you'll propagate those cells and put them back in. And now the person that had sickle cell anemia now has a lot of stem cells that have differentiated into red blood cell progenitors that don't have that sickle defect. So that's a way that you can, in a way, with a bone marrow transplant, cure sickle cell disease or with a stem cell transplant. And so one of the things I always wondered about, it's gene editing, great. What are you supposed to do? How do you edit every single gene in the body? How do you edit one gene in every single gene in the body? How do you do it just preferentially? And genes perform different functions in different parts of the body. How do you target a gene editing solution to just the tissue of interest and just the gene of interest in that tissue? And to me, that was, looming as the gotcha about gene editing. If you're not going to do the gene editing in the embryo stage where there's only a few cells that need the gene editing, mm-hmm. how do you do it in an adult human? And there's a company out there that has figured out how to do it, at least in the case of this familial hypercholesterolemia.
So it's like a little capsule that they swallow, or it's implanted?
Well, I don't know if they infuse it.
Uh-huh.
But this liposomal particle, which means it's like a soap bubble.
Okay.
So the problem is that you need to transport it and have it go to the right place. So what they do is they package it like in this liposomal particle. Let's just call it a soap bubble. And inside is these little proteins that are doing the thing of interest. Well, the soap bubble.
Huh. When it gets.
The soap bubble is designed such that only the liver takes it up.
Ah.
It has some, and I don't know the details of it, but I'd be interested to know, but it has whatever receptors are, markers. Like we all know the spike proteins in the coronavirus. Well, there's little. It's a lock and key. So the liposomal particle has the key and it fits into the lock, and only the liver cells have the lock. It takes it up. And as soon as it's into the cell, it finds its way to the nucleus and the chromosomes and goes right to that single gene and single base pair that is off in this LDL receptor, fixes it, and now the liver theoretically does not produce defective LDL receptors for clearing cholesterol. So Stormy Jones would have been an ideal candidate for getting this.
So what about if somebody just through diet and poor lifestyle has fatty liver, that would have no application? You just have to alter your diet.
Yeah, that's a different disease process.
But if you do that, can you reverse and fix your liver by improving drastically your lifestyle, your diet? And
I didn't quite get the question.
How can you get rid of your fatty liver?
Oh, so fatty liver is definitely reversible if it hasn't progressed to the point where it's caused cirrhosis. So in the liver, you guys all watch.
Well, now we're in the liver and not at the heart.
it's
still connected.
Metabolic health, which affects heart and affects brain health and affects obesity, the whole thing. Everyone knows by now that you can just take a fraction of a liver and transplant it into someone else, and it grows into a whole liver. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
I did not know that. That is really cool. It's like it's not a chia pet. It's like,
we were watching a TV show the other night where they took a small piece from mom and a small piece from dad, and they implanted them both in the person, and they grew their liver back. I don't know if that, probably not. I don't know why they would need one from each place. But the interesting thing about the liver is that there's the medical term is parenchyma. That's the actual liver cells that do the business of the liver. And then there's the stromal cells, which is the structural blood vessels, the biliary, you know, the bile ducts and all that kind of thing. That's called the stroma and or the structure of the liver. So if it's just damage to the business liver cells, you can repair that. Once you start damaging the infrastructure of the liver, though, it becomes cirrhotic, is the term. Those strands that are supporting the liver and supplying it blood and transporting bile and all that, once those start to go, then you're into the realm of needing
liver transplant.
And the term for that is called cirrhosis of the liver. Mm-hmm. So you can become cirrhotic from hepatitis C, from alcoholism, from fatty liver, from iron deposition. All kinds of things can cause you to become cirrhotic.
And would you feel that in your body if you had it and you didn't know? Like, would you feel a symptom where you'd say, I just don't feel right. I need to go to the doctor.
Well, the early signs of cirrhosis are the accumulation of fluid. So you'll see people that have advanced liver disease will start developing, you know, fluid collection in their abdomen. Mm-hmm. It's usually the first, one of the first ways you see it.
So I before I forget, I really wanted to back to the cardiovascular and the, you know, brain health. If somebody has some kind of blockage, will that affect their brain health and their memory and their ability to function?
You know, it's an interesting question. And again, back in, and this came from one of my UCLA clinical instructors. Back then, we didn't have coronary CT angios. But what we did have is we had the ability to do carotid ultrasounds. If we saw atherosclerosis in the carotid arteries, then, in his opinion and others, and I don't think this was just him, you can surmise that it's present in the heart. And if it's in the coronary arteries, you can then most likely extrapolate that it is affecting the cerebral arteries as well, and that even the very small blood vessels. So you can have this, and this is in fact the same disease process that is occurring in the coronary vessels that occurs in the brain. One's called cardiovascular disease, the other cerebrovascular disease, and there's peripheral vascular disease. The blood vessels are generally pretty similar, and break down more of not their location but their size. So the capillaries are the very smallest arteries. They're the most adversely affected by diabetes, where there's sugar deposition, you know, in those artery walls, which causes that. Things like you've heard diabetics, they'll have numb feet. Well, they have numb feet because the blood supply to the tiny pieces of blood supply to those tiny nerves gets affected. And so those nerves die off, so to speak. And you have peripheral neuropathy as a chunk. So you'll have numbness.
Okay.
But whereas, you know, the caliber of vessel that, you know, I don't know, is associated with like coronary arteries, it'll all look the same. And by the way, the aorta, the biggest artery, will also have the same process.
Was that the Widowmaker artery? Which one's the Widowmaker?
That's the left anterior descending that goes down the front of your heart and gives the blood supply to the left ventricle, which is the main thing that pumps blood out. The reason it kills people is not only because that artery subtends such a important part of the heart. When that heart starts dying, its ability to conduct the electrical signal to make the heart pump is affected. And so the person goes into what's called ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, and they die of the dysrhythmia that's caused by having that much of the heart not working.
And it's from what I've heard, just through personal experience, it's something that's not doesn't always give you any kind of symptom ahead of time that you would identify as I'm about to die. And it doesn't give time like 911 after somebody's had that that happen, that there's no like resuscitating that back. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's more or less true. That it would like that someone that goes into ventricular fibrillation outside of a hospital and isn't cardioverted pretty quickly, there isn't CPR going from that time of onset, that their chance of survival is very, very low.
What about the if they had like one of those on-site defibrillators that
Then perhaps you could start CPR and shock them back into a regular rhythm. I'm not particularly an expert on that, but I think that that would be something that would possibly save some people for sure. And actually, there's a lot of reasons you could go into ventricular fibrillation that say that you get shocked out of it with 180s defibrillators, like on the airplane or whatever.
So all of this is under the umbrella of like cardiology, would you say? All of what we talked about today is for the metabolic?
Well, I mean, heart health is largely dependent on metabolic health, as is brain health. So whenever we're talking about any of those things, metabolic health is going to go in. And then the other thing is mitochondrial health. We never even talked about the benefits of exercise when it comes to heart disease. But with all these things, metabolic health and cellular energy, which we call mitochondrial health, is all going to be key to everything. It'll be talked about over and over.
And we'll talk about it again on like our next conversation.
Thanks for joining us on the Precision Medicine Made Simple podcast. If this episode inspired you to learn more about your health, please leave us a review and share the podcast with a friend. Your feedback helps spread the word about the power of precision medicine. Remember, taking action today can lead to a healthier tomorrow. See you next time.